Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone phone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Dr. Messner, please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Krista, and I too would like to welcome everyone to the Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. And the title of today's program is Addressing the LGBTQI Plus Health Disparities Gap. And today's program is made possible through an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. I just want to say a few words before I turn this program over to our first speaker. We have over 100 participants on the call today, and you come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, the Philippines, and the United Kingdom. So it's truly a global call as well. And now I'm going to have the pleasure of introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. NFN Scout. Dr. Scout is Executive Director, National LGBTQI Plus Cancer Network, VP of Social Justice, the Torvis Group, Los Angeles, California. And Dr. Scout will be addressing an overview of cancer and the LGBTQI Plus community, the LGBTQI Plus community's disproportionate cancer burden. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Scout.
Thanks, Dr. Messner. I always appreciate being on your calls. I usually learn something myself and really appreciate all the amazing people that you bring on to try and help make sure we get information out as far and wide as possible. So with the LGBTQI+, and I would actually even say communities, because we don't always overlap or gel into a single community, right? We're in an interesting situation right now because we have a historical set of existing barriers, which has already changed our cancer trajectory. But in addition, it's pretty hard to talk about what's going on with our access to care unless you also note the fact that right now we're having absolutely unprecedented rollbacks in efforts to try and even address issues with our population. For example, we have had 100% of NIH-funded LGBTQI research, health research, terminated in the last 3 months. We have also had people who are forbidden by their universities, as the universities have to sign contracts with the federal government. They will not do, quote, DEI work. So people are being forbidden from actually including our populations in research at other places. And we also have organizations that are pulling back from any visible demonstration that they're welcoming to our communities, healthcare organizations and cancer centers. And that just means for many of us, our challenges are starting to really multiply. And one of the other things we have is that there is all the federal data collection on our population has also been absolutely terminated. So kind of following that, some of that precedent, if I'm going to give an overview of how our populations are differentially impacted by cancer, I'm going to do it with some stories of a bunch of friends of mine, and hopefully they'll be illustrative of how it is our situation is going to often differ from other people. So first of all, if we think of the cancer care continuum, prevention, screening, diagnosis, treatment, and survivorship, I'll just give you some illustrative stories in each one of those five areas so that you can see how our experience differs. The first one, obviously prevention. So one of my friends named Alice is one of the many people, unfortunately, in our communities who uses combustible cigarettes and has been smoking her whole life. And I watched with Alice as she ended up, it's kind of a socially contagious disease, right? As she ended up being part of a large group of queer women who were smoking as they continued to age, even as they went through their own, unfortunately, the passing and cancer diagnoses of several people in that group. It's something that really has spread very broadly. And our population overall has tobacco use rates that are about 40% higher than the general population. Considering how much cancer that is connected with, that alone means that we are absolutely going to have a disproportionate cancer burden compared to the general population. Then, and also just to say, Alice is also the mother of my kids. So this is one of those ways that it really hits home very closely. And partially as a result of that, one of my kids also smokes, despite the fact that I've spent my whole life on cancer control here. And then if we move on to screening, we did some story finding with people this last year when we were listening to trans folks about how the legislative attacks with 500 bills last year and 800 this year aimed against our communities have affected their arc towards or away from cancer. And Javon was one of the guys we talked with, and he had a very poignant story that he has gotten a provider just to do his immediate health need, which in his case is hormones. But that doesn't mean that it's actually a primary care provider providing you with prophylactic screening, things like that. And so he's not getting the rounded care that we would expect and hope people get. And we heard this story repeated over and over with more people because it's such a challenge to get providers to treat you with dignity that we often just honestly are out of gas by the time we get to one, and it doesn't mean we're all the way to cancer screening. And also just to say, I asked Javon, like, what would happen, because he lives in Texas, a not very welcoming state, if you got something life-threatening, like potentially a cancer diagnosis. And unfortunately, we're going to hear this story again. As he told us, he would just peace out. He never expected to live that long. He would take that as a sign. He wouldn't even pursue treatment. And he was one of several, like Dianye was another one we talked to, where she was not able to tell us that she would be able to find one welcoming provider if she got something like a cancer diagnosis. And she also was not getting screening in her state as well. So that's unfortunately a theme we're seeing emerging. Move on to diagnosis. Our diagnosis experiences can often be delayed. Stanford did a study this year, a few years ago, with one type of cancer, but it was one of those rare outcome studies where we can figure out what is the outcome differences. And they found that we were on average twice as long, about twice as long to get diagnosis as non-sexual and gender minority people. And just as some examples of that, we have Chris Harris, one of the, our buddies here in the city where I'm in right now, who went to his doctor complaining for throat pain again and again. That doctor didn't understand that gay guys were at increased risk of HPV-related cancers, never checked it out. By the time his throat cancer was found, it was too late. He didn't have the options. He's no longer with us today. Or Tony Billings Walker, luckily, is still with us. He went to his doctor for 6 months complaining about, in this case, butt pain. And as he jokes to this day, he gets more action on the first date with a stranger than he got with his doctor in 6 months. And when they finally did a rectal exam on him, it was easy to determine that it was cancer. Luckily, again, he was in a situation where it could be treated. But you can see how these delays based upon, you know, the ideas that the providers are coming with, the biases that the providers are coming with, are unfortunately complicating for all of us. Then you move on to treatment. You know, one of the people who works with us now, his name is Ash, and he talked about how despite getting a welcoming provider after his cancer was found during gender-affirming surgery, despite getting a welcoming surgeon and provider he trusted, he'd walk into that, you know, big cancer waiting room with so many people around, and they would call Ms. Davidson every single time he had to go up for his chemo because they were misgendering him. So as he talked about, he didn't just have to deal with the cancer. He didn't just have to deal with the effects of chemo. He also, because he also lives in Texas, had to worry about the idea of was he going to be beaten up on his way back to the car because of the way they forced outed him every single time he got a chemo visit. Or there was a woman I was just presenting with last week, Sophia out of California, brought up a new dimension related to this that I hadn't even thought about. She's stage 4 cancer, and she is, you know, struggling to get through that treatment and raise her kids out in Southern California. They're offering her a clinical trial as one of her best lifelines to hope, but the one they're offering her is at MD Anderson, which is an incredibly hostile state. So she cannot imagine the idea of moving her family over to an incredibly hostile state because that is the option she's given for a clinical trial. Or the last example here, and unfortunately this goes back to Javon's story, is a woman named Lynette. So older lesbian, got a diagnosis of pancreatic cancer, was offered one of the rare curative options of surgical interventions, things like that. But after exactly one chemo round, which was rough, she also echoed Javon's sentiment and said, sorry, I'm just peacing out. I never thought I'd live that long. This is good. And I'm sorry to say that Lynette is also my mother. So as a lesbian, you know, woman, I watched her as a lesbian go through this, and it was frustrating to see that that whole concept of this is too much, I've already experienced too much, is being echoed at the extreme end, you know, between black trans guys and older white lesbians of our community population. So we're really concerned about kind of how we come in with less resources to fight something like this. And then we move on to survivorship as the last area. You know, again and again, we hear that our people don't get tailored resources for us. They don't get access to tailored support groups. They don't get access to things like sex after cancer. Garza is another one of my buddies who talks about how, you know, after his cancer, all they could give him was cisgender heterosexual sex information. And as someone who's in a gay relationship, that not only didn't hit for him, didn't help him, but it left him feeling much more isolated and alone. So I would just wind this all up to say that one of the good things we have is we know that our experience going through the trajectory of cancer can be really changed by exactly one thing. That's that our chance of being very pleased with our cancer experience goes up over sixfold if we can figure out the provider's offices are welcoming. So that is clearly the big change area we need to focus on now. With that, I'll turn it back over.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Scouts. That was really an amazing, stellar presentation. Just, and you're the first speaker to start off today's program, so thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Kevin Moore. Dr. Moore is System Director of LGBTQI Plus Health and Wellness, NYU Langone Health. He will be addressing health care, cancer screening, palliative and supportive care, affordable housing, gay men and lesbian cancer issues, and transgender, gender nonconforming people's cancer concerns. It is my pleasure to introduce my esteemed colleague, Dr. Moore.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. And Dr. Scout, always a pleasure to hear you. It's no surprise why so many of us are inspired by you to do this work. But yeah, just a few topics. So really, cancer doesn't discriminate, but you know, cancer care often does. LGBTQ patients face really unique disparities across the cancer care continuum: screening, diagnosis, treatment, survivorship, palliative care, and life care. And a lot of healthcare systems are really not prepared. They're not prepared to meet the needs because identity is erased or ignored in cancer data, education and policy, and you know, recently has gotten even more ignored. It might be just temporary though, because so many of us are really still working on things, and we'll continue to work to make things better for people. You know, preventative care, let's talk about screenings, because really there's missed opportunities here in cancer prevention. And preventative care isn't really reaching everyone, right? It's LGBTQ people are less likely to receive routine cancer screenings. What are the routine cancer screenings? Do we have routine cancer screenings for LGBTQ people? Not really. And so that's something that we've been working on in conjunction with the LGBT Cancer Network. But, you know, things like pap smears, colonoscopies, prostate exams, barriers are past trauma, discrimination in healthcare, a fear of coming in and not being recognized for who you are, not being honored for who you are. Dr. Scout speak to being misgendered. So you have a lack of culturally competent providers. So, you know, last thing you want to do is go and receive care from someone who has no idea who you are. And, you know, from the clinical perspective, from the provider perspective, many providers want to take care of LGBTQ people, but they're not educated around those cultural issues and clinical ones. So, and then inadequate insurance, inadequate big coverage gaps for gender-affirming bodies, and depending a place on where you live. Clinical guidelines aren't inclusive. You have national screening guidelines are very, very based on largely white, cisgender, heterosexual populations. And a lot of trans and non-binary people, especially non-binary people, fall through the cracks. Trans men with cervixes may not be offered pap smears, and trans women on estrogen may not be screened for prostate cancer, and people assume wrongly, providers, what organs patients have or don't have based on their appearance or identity. So it speaks to trust. It speaks to the ability to have a rapport with your provider. A lot of my work is very much based on patient experience, being culturally, there's so many different words for this, competent, intelligent, humble, to just be aware of who people are. But patients will avoid that care if they anticipate judgment, if they anticipate misgendering, or a provider who doesn't understand who they are. So we need to be able to have open-ended questions about body parts. We need to educate people on how to ask that. We need to talk to people about making what kind of risk comes without making assumptions. So the consequences are measurable and they're preventable. We know that when these things are in place, cervical cancer screening among lesbian and bisexual women and transmasculine people goes down. Breast cancer screening happens more often with trans individuals. HPV vaccination in LGBTQ youth goes up. So we know that it is better when we are better. So we need to train providers. We need to update guidelines. We need to collect SOGI data, sexual orientation and gender identity data, so we can know more. We also need people to be able to give that data, self-report that data, and not just get it at the point of care. And we need to foster environments where LGBTQ people feel safe and respected and seen, especially now. So I think what's also really, Dr. Scott spoke of this, inclusive data, right? Identity inclusive data. That's why it's also important to collect SOGI. But I think it's really important to talk about affordable housing. And I was glad to see that, because it's one of the determinants that's often left out here, right? Stable housing is essential for maintaining treatment schedules. And it can help manage side effects. It can help access follow-up care. LGBTQ individuals face instability and living in unaffirming or unsafe environments, and the stress that's magnified. So what does that do? That's hypervigilance, right? And hypervigilance compromises immune function, compromises a person's ability to adhere to the care schedule, and of course, mental health, which is the number one issue right now. The number one issue in the LGBTQ community is the lack of access to providers, to talk about mental, to therapists for mental health, the lack of insurance coverage, the great out-of-pocket expense. So trans people and LGBTQ people of color, disproportionately affected by poverty, discrimination, and homelessness, disproportionately affected by income disparity, and cancer patients can all also have estrangement from families or support systems. So, you know, asking questions about what kind of support people have. And the cost of living, of course, is a crisis, right? So in New York, it is so expensive. We just had a major upset in the mayoral race because the new candidate is running on lowering the rent. The cost of living in New York has skyrocketed. It was already expensive enough. But, you know, again, LGBTQ patients face job loss, reduced hours due to illness, and don't have the financial safety net that many cisgender heterosexual patients have. Without paid leave and family support, housing protections, you know, people are, what are you going to choose when you have to choose between housing and health, right? So if you're couch surfing, or you're living in a shelter, or you feel unsafe at home, how do you safely manage essential life? How do you have a refrigerator to put your medications in? How do you get proper sleep? And gender-affirming housing matters. Trans and non-binary patients, community shelters, groups homes, assisted living may misgender or deny appropriate placement. This happens so often, and this is so important that we have places, and we don't have enough places where people can go and be able to have stable housing that is proficient in culturally and clinically. And then, of course, solutions maybe have to be intersectional. So cancer centers have to collaborate with housing organizations, and create referral pathways for LGBTQ patients and affordable, affirming medical respite housing like they do in Massachusetts, especially, you know, post-surgical or post-radiation. Totally, totally life-saving. And then policy and philanthropy really need to include LGBTQ cancer survivors in housing and equity conversations. You know, it's hard enough to fight cancer. Fighting for a place to live while fighting for your life is a cruelty no one should face. And lastly, let me just say something about allyship, because there's many cisgender heterosexual people that are true allies. Allyship at its core is not performative. It's not a one-month gesture. It's not a social media post. It's the work of presence, and it's the daily choice to stand with someone who may not have the same safety and freedom or access that you do. It is speaking up when it would be easier to stay silent and choosing courage when comfort is an option. That is truer now than it ever was. Thanks.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Moore. That was just a really outstanding presentation. Stella, you really covered a lot of topics, and I know there'll be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A, but this was just a stellar presentation, and you really identified a number of the areas that are so critically important for the community. So thank you so much, and so look forward to the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Stuart Fleischman. Dr. Fleischman is former founding director, Cancer Support Services, Continuum Cancer Centers of New York, now part of the Mount Sinai Health System. He's an author and researcher in oncology. And Dr. Fleischman will be addressing the Social Security disability benefits for LGBTQI plus people living with cancer and military service and the LGBTQI plus community. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Fleischman.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you for everybody participating in this call, whether as a speaker or a listener, and hopefully you'll have some good questions during the question and answer period. As you've heard, often in the LGBTQI plus community, the lack of social support from either nuclear family, mostly, has made us much more reliant on what benefits we can get. And when it comes to benefits like getting a disability benefit, it's a complex situation. And it often depends upon if you have any sort of disability coverage through your employer, if you are employed, and how to access that. And often there are carve-out periods where it won't begin for 60 days or 90 days, and there's a certain level of disability that you need to have. Sometimes they begin right away. It really depends. But many people, or probably most people, don't have access to that private disability benefit, and they need to rely on the disability benefits that come from the federal government. And as you heard, things are changing constantly, but from the way I understand it, as of today, there are a specific definition of disability within which you just can't engage in what they call substantial gainful activity due to a medically determined physical or mental condition. And that is that disability, that illness or that condition needs to be expected to last with reasonable certainty for more than a year and be life-limiting. That's a very narrow definition, but that's the definition from the Social Security Administration, who, although this has nothing to do with retirement, where most of us think about Social Security, it is administered by the Social Security Administration. As of now in 2025, the maximum benefit is $1,620 a month. And there are many, many conditions to meet before you're eligible for that. In addition to having all the paperwork done saying what disability, what illness or condition you have, that it's expected to last more than a year, that it may be a life-limiting or is a life-limiting illness or condition. You need to have worked for the 5 out of the last 10 years in a way that can be documented. So you would have had to contribute to the Social Security system. And some employers, and this varies from state to state, actually put some money into either a state disability program or the federal disability program. So getting help from somebody who really understands the system, what you need to, what kind of documentation you need to have, and exactly parsing who's eligible for this benefit and who isn't, is really the best way to go about this. I think unless you work in this full time, it's very hard to keep track of all of these requirements. There is also a list of job descriptions that for which the Social Security Administration uses to see if you're eligible or not. And from what I understand, many of these job descriptions have not been updated for many, many years. So there is a job description list, let's say, for linotyping, people who would set up printing presses, and we know that much of our printing is not done by printing presses anymore. From also what I understand, a lot of the newer type job descriptions are either not included or they haven't been updated, and it's hard to kind of figure out what the job description is compared to the actual work that you do. If you are eligible, again, after working 5 out of the past 10 years, the payments will start after the first 6 months. So you need to be able to sustain yourself for those initial 6 months, and that becomes difficult for many, many, many people. There are different rules for people who are self-employed, I think a little more complex than we can get into on a general information call. It follows the same type of pattern where there are specific guidelines about the kind of work you do, and if the kind of work you do is the same as an employee would do or more sophisticated than an actual employee would do, but I think that's for another time. One of the things that people also confuse with this is the Social Security disability benefits, where a same-sex couple or a two-gendered couple can actually get benefits based on their spouse's retiree status if they were born before January of 1954. That does not occur with disability benefits. So that's purely a retirement benefit that many of us really aren't really familiar with the difference until we're actually faced with having to collect or to even apply for disability. So just keep that in mind. There's, as far as I know, no spousal disability benefit. It is very complex. Reach out for help for people who know the system really, really well and can help with the paperwork and help guide the providers on how to fill that paperwork out. The other topic that Dr. Messner wanted us to just touch on today is what's happening in the military. This has been a great disappointment for many of us because there are executive orders that prohibit transgender care as well as transgender individuals from participating in the military. It's a terrible time, especially for people who have contributed greatly to the military and invested their careers in the military. I think that this may be a sort of a changing environment. It may get more stringent. It may ease up. I'm not sure anybody can predict that now, but this is only starting over the last few months. And in addition, the Veterans Administration, who actually has been responsible to provide treatment for people with gender dysphoria, were instructed not to provide any treatment for gender dysphoria to patients who are presenting now and have not been in the system treated for gender dysphoria. Again, very much of a disappointment, and as we've heard, could be life-threatening to many people. But this is the situation that we're in now, and I'm not sure, I don't know if anybody is really certain about what to do about it for now, but we just need to be aware of what's happening so that we can get the support we need from the organizations that are out there to help us through these very difficult times. With that, I will turn the call back to Dr. Messner.
Just a wonderful, stellar presentation, and we definitely are living in very, very complex, difficult times, and I think you did an excellent job highlighting some of the issues, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Austin Waters, and Dr. Waters is postdoctoral fellow, Population Sciences, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Harvard LGBTQI Plus Health Center of Excellence, Harvard University. And he'll be addressing the LGBTQI Plus Health Disparities Gap, including mistrust of healthcare providers and challenges for LGBTQI caregivers. It's my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Waters.
Perfect. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for everyone for being here. Today, I'll briefly highlight ongoing health disparities experienced by LGBTQI plus people, the mistrust we feel towards health systems, and often overlooked challenges LGBTQ plus caregivers face. These issues affect health outcomes for survivors, caregivers, and require action at every level of healthcare delivery. So let's get into it a little bit. So we know that LGBTQ plus people have higher rates of many outcomes such as depression, anxiety, suicidality, as well as delayed and reduced access to care, including cancer screening, as folks have talked about, as well as chronic disease care. We also know these disparities are driven by structural forces such as anti-LGBTQ plus stigma and are compounded when multiple systems of oppression or stigma overlap. We see even larger disparity gaps and higher rates of reduced access to care among transgender survivors, gender expansive survivors, young adult LGBTQ plus survivors, and LGBTQ plus survivors of color. Intersectional stigma leads to worsened outcomes across the board, no matter how we shake it around. However, all these things happen in the context of our sociopolitical climate and history. So I'd like to point out in the past decade that non-HIV LGBTQ health research funding has finally begun to grow, focusing on cancer, mental health, and aging. However, as Dr. Scout and others have mentioned, under the current federal administration, we've seen a sharp reversal in that trend, with many LGBT or most LGBTQ plus specific research programs defunded or terminated altogether. This undermines the evidence-based care and further marginalizes LGBTQ plus communities in science and policy. Historically, we think about how mistrust is put together or manifested. We think about it in the context of historical and ongoing harm, right? We know that discrimination, pathologization, and being treated as an other has been rampant in healthcare forever. We know that there's a history of trauma of healthcare for LGBTQ plus individuals, from HIV plus individuals being denied care in the 80s to attacks on gender affirming care happening today. Many LGBTQ plus patients, regardless of identity or geographic region, still face misgendering, inappropriate questioning, or outright denial of care. About 1 in 5 LGBTQ plus people report having to teach their providers about LGBT health concerns in general, let alone have confidence in that those providers will be able to address those concerns. all of these things are implicit and woven through the mistrust that LGBTQ plus individuals that we feel towards health systems. Mistrust has serious impacts on health, including delayed or avoided care, underreporting of symptoms, and medical trauma. Mistrust isn't irrational, it's a rational response to prior harm. There are some interventional approaches and things happening within systems and outside of systems, great work being done by the National LGBTQ plus Cancer Network and others around training, around cultural humility, competence trainings that exist for in oncology spaces. They're often underutilized and don't get implemented past training. Recent research highlighted the need for further training in healthcare providers to have direct and clear conversations with LGBTQ plus survivors and caregivers throughout the cancer continuum. But there are also institutional actions that can be made to continue to build trust with the LGBTQ plus community outside of the direct interactions for care. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the challenges for LGBTQ plus cancer caregivers, a topic that some of my research revolves around at the moment. So LGBTQ plus cancer caregivers provide informal care to individuals with cancer. So this is often a family member, a friend. We know that caregiving is hard, which I know from my own personal experience, but which is further complicated when anti-LGBTQ plus stigma is at play. Many LGBTQ plus cancer care caregivers are unpaid, under-supported, chosen family members, partners, friends, or community members. They're not legally recognized in many ways. They face unique stressors from a lack of recognition within the health systems, being excluded from care discussions, just charging plans or decision-making. They face legal barriers, challenging to accessing leave, benefits, or bereavement support. They're also involved in instances of discrimination, assumptions of being just friends, or reluctance to close identity in hostile care settings, as folks have talked about. As well, these caregivers face a higher risk of caregiver burnout, social isolation, and financial hardship. So I want to talk through, over the next couple of minutes, a couple of case examples of my own research that highlights some of the complexity of caregiving as an LGBTQ plus person and the accessing to support both informal, such as friends and family, and formal support through institutions. So first is an example of a 39-year-old gay man who's caring for his partner he lives with. The partner in this example was not out. So when his family came to town to visit and helped take care of him during or after treatment, his partner would have to vacate their home to avoid outing him. In this situation, the caregiver was removed from the possibility of interpersonal discrimination, at least from his partner's family, but was also not able to access support from the patient's family or social network, as well as the healthcare system. And the second example is of a 28-year-old non-binary caregiver who's providing care to their father. The caregiver is the only person in their family who's trained to do some specific care tasks. Some of these care tasks are quite intensive. And they're expected to make their work schedule work around in response to these care tasks. However, this caregiver, over the past handful of years, has been continuously misgendered and bullied by their father about their identity, including during the caregiving experience. In this example, the caregiver did access caregiver supports through the Cancer Center, which was great, but was also exposed to misgendering and harassment from the patient themselves. I talked through these two examples to highlight that caregiving as an LGBTQ plus person is more complicated than just the dichotomy that is often talked about through acceptance or complete familial rejection, and that there's an in-between that can cause stress and complicates relationships and situations, which in addition to minority stress and hypervigilance is associated in my research with substantially worse health throughout the continuum. So what clinicians can do, or providers, health system individuals, first of all, affirming identity and family structures. Ask patients who they consider family and respect those decisions. Collect SOGI data, as we talked about, respectfully and routinely, but also with just very clear privacy protections. Create visibly inclusive spaces. So things like signage, pronoun use, staff trainings, all those things matter. Acknowledge and support caregivers, regardless of legal or biological ties. And most importantly, to use your voice to support LGBTQ plus survivors and caregivers from care to research. So in closing, I'll just say LGBTQI plus individuals and caregivers are resilient, but resilience should not be a prerequisite for equitable care. We can build trust and reduce disparities and support caregivers, but only if we're proactive, informed, and inclusive in our practice. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Waters. That was an outstanding presentation. Quite stellar and really including a lot of important topics. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Mr. Daniel LaPook, and Mr. LaPook is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. And he'll be addressing the practical, financial, emotional, and social concerns. Cancer Care's free national programs and services. He'll also be giving information about our national hope line and website, and also cancer resources for the LGBTQI plus community. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Mr. LaPook.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. Hi, everyone. As Dr. Messner said, my name is Daniel LaPook, and I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. So I'm going to be giving an overview of our services. We are a national nonprofit organization providing free professional supportive services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include a resource navigation service, counseling and support groups, educational workshops like today, publications, and limited financial assistance. So to become connected to these services, those who are interested can call our National Hope Line, which can be reached at 800-813-4673. That's 800-813-4673. And they will be connected with a member of our social services team. When they do speak with a member of our team, which includes oncology social workers, someone does an assessment of needs that helps determine how we can best offer support. So we can always connect callers with extensive resources that help address their concerns, whether they be financial in nature, emotional, or practical and logistical. So someone calling might be eligible for our resource navigation service, where they're paired with someone to help develop a comprehensive list of organizations and programs that can really offer that specialized support, what they're looking for. We do offer short-term individual counseling and support groups that meet through Zoom to New York and New Jersey residents. And we have online groups that meet through a message board format that are available to anyone in the United States, Puerto Rico, and U.S. territories. So these online message board groups, they're for patients, they're also for caregivers and those who have lost somebody to cancer. We have educational workshops like the one we're on today, publications that provide reliable information, whether that's by cancer type, or general topics too, like how to navigate clinical trials, grief and loss, and best practices for speaking with children and teens about cancer. So again, that Hope Line number I mentioned before is a good way to get connected to those services. We also do have a website, www.cancercare.org. With regard to our programming for the LGBTQI plus communities, we actually recently launched two online support groups that meet through a message board format. One is an LGBTQI plus patient group, and the other is an LGBTQI plus caregiver group. And so we're really excited to provide clients with a space that promotes inclusion, safety, and a sense of belonging for members of these communities who are also impacted by cancer. And I think our presenters just did such a wonderful job of, you know, reiterating the need for that connection. So these online groups offer an opportunity to connect with other people on topics like how to approach self-care, how to respond to certain side effects and symptoms, best practices for communicating with healthcare professionals, also loved ones about how to communicate about their diagnosis. And then we can also connect people to local resources as well, ways to find providers, including doctors and therapists who provide culturally competent or humble support. So we're able to really talk to the individual and see how we can best attend to their needs. And we're very much looking forward to continue building this programming. We hope to be developing more as we move forward and look forward to sharing those and hopefully future workshops like this. So with that, I'll turn it back to Dr. Messner, and thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Letzook, and Ms. Letzook, and I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. But now we're going to move right on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Krista how everyone can queue up and ask questions. Krista?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So I'm going to start quite a few questions here. So this is a question for Dr. Scout. What advice do you have for parents, guardians of LGBTQ plus youth?
That's just broadly, not necessarily cancer specific.
That's true.
I do. I have plenty of ideas related to this. You know, many of us came out as queer youth ourselves, and we know, unfortunately, that the risk of people becoming depressed and suicidal because they can understand and very clearly see the fact that society does not seem to want us is really high. So that means the very first thing, we know this, that the chance of a queer youth going suicidal drops eightfold if they have even just one supportive adult in their life. So I would even broaden this to say this isn't just for parents of queer youth, but anybody who knows anybody where there's a queer youth somewhere in your life. Don't overestimate the fact that those youth have that one really accepting and supportive person. You know, whether it's just a parent who's like, well, you know, I know you wanted that new name, but, you know, I'm so used to calling the old one that I'll just use the old names, the old pronouns, right? I can't get my name, can't get my head around using they, them as a pronoun or something like that. All of those sorts of things are a reinforcement to that youth that they're not welcome and accepted for who they genuinely are. So don't presume that those people have that kind of support, and really go out of your way to spend some time with them, listen to them, try and build a relationship, try and be that source of absolutely unconditional support. And sometimes it also means you really have to champion for those people, because those youth, for example, might want to go on hormone blockers so they're not forced into a puberty that doesn't fit their brain. And in cases like that, we see parents all around the country right now giving up their jobs, giving up their friendship circles because they're trying to get their kids to some place that's safer for them to actually get the medical care that they need. Or in some cases, like Javon, that guy talked about, helps people fly away from hostile states into more welcoming states in order to get the medical care that they need. So there's lots of ways that you know, people need this really active engagement these days. But another one of them, very specific and related to cancer, is we need to get these youth to welcoming healthcare providers so that they can have a medical home, someone who can push them to get the screenings they may not think they need because it may have to do with body parts they don't even think they have, right? But also get HPV vaccination when they're in their highest window of that being effective. So don't be quiet. Be really active. Be really welcoming. Develop a relationship and focus on getting that person stabilized for both their mental and their physical health.
Thank you so much, Dr. Scout. And another question for Dr. Moore. Are there other STIs besides HPV and HIV that increase risk for cancer?
That's a really great question. And I'm Dr. Scout, do you know that? If there's STIs that increase cancer risk? I mean, I think they make cancer worse.
Yeah, I feel like one of the big things we got to remember is that HPV is not cleared with some of us, particularly if we're HIV positive. So, you know, that's something that is a sexually transmitted phenomena, right? So we really having increases in things like anal cancer, throat cancer, and it's predominantly clustered in the queer communities because you give us, you know, about 10 years of being HIV positive, HPV is not cleared, and next thing you know, those HPV-related cancer risks are really, really going up. And then you add on the fact that we don't even know that, you know, the age now to get a vaccination for HPV has gone up to, I think, 46, and information is still not well spread. You know, we were just on an HPV presentation yesterday where 2011 was when we stopped saying it's just for women and girls. It's for all people. And yet there's still that myth out there that somehow it's really just for women or girls. And so we've got a lot of education gaps that need to be filled related to
that's
that.
Right.
So I would say it's predominantly HPV.
That's right.
Risks.
Not nearly as well. But I went to a great discussion the other day with a new PA that we're working with who does a lot of work in anal cancer and HPV. And he was saying in particular that, you know, there isn't this huge connection that people think with anal cancer and HPV. But he was saying that people need to get their HPV vaccination, and that, you know, there's so much that we can prevent. So in essence of like, is there, if you get this, you're more than likely to get that. I don't know if those are so tied together as much as we can, unless it's cervical cancer, right? So,
well, if you're HIV positive, there's a stronger
connection. If you're HIV positive, right. Yes.
Excellent. Let's see.
But even more of a reason for you to have great primary care and be able to have a relationship with that primary care physician, to be able to talk about who you are, what genders of the partners that you have, what kind of sex that you have. Do you need to be protected by sexual people or have some of the highest STI rates out of all of the community? So that's really important.
Excellent. And for Dr. Waters, I am at higher risk for HPV. I just wanted to know, in association with HPV, are there specific cancers I should be screened for sooner?
Oh, that's a great, I don't know, that's a great question. I'm not necessarily a cancer screening expert, I'd say, but maybe Scout or some other folks on the call would have a better idea.
Head and neck, throat, anal, there's even potential connection to colorectal, and I believe a potential, obviously cervical, and then a potential connection to prostate too. So those, so honestly, the ends of your body, or the middle and the top of your body. How's that?
Excellent.
The orifice ends, right? The hole. That's it.
Entry point.
That's it.
Yeah.
Entry
Excellent.
Point. Or exit.
Or exit. We Excellent. Hope on a regular basis.
Excellent. And then we now, I'm going to ask actually for our speakers to provide a takeaway from today's program. I would like to start with Dr. Fleischman.
If you are diagnosed with cancer and can't work, please connect with a social worker or benefits manager or somebody who can help sort out these very complex rules. To see that you can get whatever benefits you're eligible for.
Excellent. And Dr. Scout?
You know, I didn't exactly mention this my thing, but one of the things that's hard to convince queer people about is that if you're treated better by your doctor, by the way they socially treat you, you'll actually be healthier. So it's not just the pills they give you. So if you're getting shade from your provider or your provider's office, things like that, and if you have the ability to get to a provider who you feel more comfortable with, do it, because that will help your health.
Excellent. Thank you. Let's see. Dr. Moore.
I would jump on what Dr. Scout said and say that if you feel that you can't go in and talk to your clinician to take care of you, tell them who you are, have frank discussions, honest discussions about who you are, then you're not with the right clinician. In order to find those right clinicians, that can be challenging. You can look to organizations like the Cancer Network, which has a pretty great extensive list of providers that are out there. It's not a perfect science. More than certainly reach out to me. If you're in the New York area, there's plenty of people that I could send you to, but build that relationship with your providers. Be honest about who you are. Go in and get screenings. Protect yourself from STIs, and, you know, that's really the best advice I could give.
Mr. LePook, your takeaway.
Yeah, I would say for my takeaway, you know, the importance of self-advocacy. So thinking about what resources can you access that will help you better advocate for yourself. These systems are designed in a way that are extremely complex and confusing and unhelpful often. And, you know, how can you access resources like the LGBT Cancer Network, Cancer Care, you know, to help you navigate these very complex systems and advocate for yourself. So that would be my takeaway.
Excellent. And Dr. Waters?
Yeah, I think my takeaway would be is that trust is built, not assumed. So to reduce disparities, we need to go beyond good intentions and start to embed inclusion in every policy, interaction, and clinical decision.
And I'm going to ask actually our speakers to provide me with any type of resources that we can send. We do send a SurveyMonkey evaluation to everybody who is on the program today. And in that SurveyMonkey evaluation, it's an evaluation of the program, which you'll get in about 10 days. But you'll also be getting all the resources that our speakers have at their disposal. They'll send them to me, and we'll send it to all of you so that you'll be able to have access to incredible resources as well. Does that make sense to our speakers? Just send me whatever resources you would recommend. So I really just want to thank our speakers. This has been a superb program. I want to thank both our speakers and our participants as well, because our participants asked such great questions. We couldn't take all of them, of course. There are just too many of you on the call. But we were able to take some of your questions. And so I want to comment about the questions. But I do want to thank both our speakers and participants who really made this program so terrific and so informative. And we will be doing this program again, so rest assured. But I do want to comment on, for those of you who got to ask a question, go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your question. And the same is true for those who are in queue, didn't get to ask a question. Take your question back to your treating healthcare team. Remember, they have all your records. You've learned a lot from the program, and you'll basically ask more informed questions. Also, we have discovered that for many people, reaching your physician during the day is not as troublesome as it is. Usually you can reach somebody during the day, but evenings, weekends, and holidays tend to be a difficult time. So please be sure to get the phone numbers that you can access your healthcare team evenings, weekends, and holidays. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. You've been a phenomenal group, and this has been a phenomenal program. I cannot thank our speakers enough or our participants for your amazing participation today. Again, I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.